24 people will make up six crews of four, and they will blast off to the red planet every 2 years beginning in 2024. It will be a one-way trip. As a matter of fact, some people all over the country. Michigan woman has been selected, a couple in St. Louis. We're going to talk with Robert Zubrin in a moment. He's an expert on Mars, heads up the MarsSociety.org website. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zubrin, of course, president of Pioneer Astronautics and the Mars Society, as well as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy as well. He has studied and researched fields of aerospace, energy. He's a doctor, a PhD in nuclear engineering as well. He's an author, Merchants of Despair, How to Live on Mars, The Case for Mars. He's got a whole bunch of them on his website, MarsSociety.org. Robert, always a pleasure to bring you back. What a great time. What a great story. How are you, first of all?
I'm fine, and thanks for having me back.
Sure thing. My pleasure. So they have selected, they're down to what, 100 people now, and they got to get it down to 24 to go to Mars?
Yeah.
What's the criteria, Robert? What do they do?
Oh, I don't know exactly what their criteria are, but they are trying to select people who, you know, if they get the funds and muster the resources to do the mission, that these people can do it. I have met, not all of them by any stretch, but I've met a sampling of them. And my estimate is that of this 100, 20 or 30 of them are people as good as those who NASA recruits for the astronaut corps.
These people who are going, it's a one-way trip. So what kind of mindset, who would volunteer for something like that, Robert?
Well, I had somebody ask me the other day, you know, do you think these people are crazy? No, I think they're very optimistic. They're not terribly realistic in terms of their chances of getting to go. Not merely because of the down selection process, but also because of the fact that Mars One does not, at this point, have anything like the resources to do this. But they're not crazy at all. What they are people who want to do something really important with their lives. And it's not a suicide mission. It's a settlement mission. And so, you know, we're all on a one-way trip to somewhere. And what these people are saying is what they want to do on their one-way trip is do something really important.
Yeah, they all feel that way. There's a Maggie Duckworth out of St. Louis. She's an electrical engineer. She sees this as her way of, you know, a stepping stone in human galactic expansion. And, you know, there they will be. Explain to me, Robert, technically, what the layout will be on Mars.
Well, okay, they're flying one way to Mars, and then they will land in the habitat craft that they fly to Mars in, much as we do, in fact, in my Mars Direct mission plan, except that there is no return craft waiting for them there. And these things would be landed, and then they'd be moved close together and mated up so that you would be able to travel from one into the next, so you would have basically a series of houses, if you will, in which you could just walk from one to the other without having to put on a spacesuit and go outside, so that you could make a fair amount of living space that way, and then they'd also establish greenhouses and where you could grow plants, and if those are pressurized sufficiently, you could have pressurized space, breathable air there as well. There's a lot of technical details that need to be worked out here, and in fact, a group from MIT went through the exercise of critiquing their technical designs, but I think that's all totally besides the point. If Mars One actually does get the money to do anything like this, they will have the money to hire a first-class engineering team that will iron out all this.
I would be going bonkers, I think, if I was there living in these bubble homes. I would miss good old planet Earth, Robert.
Well, sure. But if you compare, I mean, look, we send people out in submarines, and they typically are on a 6-month tour.
Yes.
And, certainly for that length of time, they do not go bonkers. And people going into the space station is also typically a 6-month tour, and they do not go bonkers up there. Now, of course, this is longer than that. This is years and years and years. This is it. But on the other hand, they're not as confined to someone who would be in a submarine because they can go outside in spacesuits and explore the vast terrain. And, in fact, that's one of the important things for them to do. The question of whether you'd go bonkers or not, it's a question of temperament. And so they do want to select the right people.
Do you think it's going to work? Do you think this is really possible?
Well, there's a double question there. First of all, is it technically possible? Absolutely. One of the virtues of the one-way plan is that it makes it more technically possible because you eliminate all the technical challenges associated with developing the return hardware and doing the return trip. There's no doubt, for example, that NASA could do this. NASA could do this in a heartbeat. Not a heartbeat, but certainly within 10 years, if President Obama was to announce, I am committing the nation to send people to Mars to stay, we could do this. The question of whether Mars One can do it is a different story because these are people with rather limited resources. And it has to be said, and this is very important, because I do not think that Mars One current business plan is sound at all. I just want to emphasize.
Right,
that.
And you're not part of Mars One. You've got your own organization out there.
Yeah, the Mars Society.
That's
we promote
right.
Mars exploration, and we wish Mars One well, and we have allowed Mars One to send speakers to our conferences. And by the way, our next international conference will be in Washington, D.C. This August. There's information about it at marssociety.org.
And great.
This will be very easy for Americans to go to, and there will probably be a speaker from Mars One there at one of the sessions, and they can hear more about it there. But the Mars One proposes to fund this with a reality TV show, and I just think that is a non-starter. You couldn't fund one Mars mission with a reality show. But they have to do much more than fund one Mars mission. They have to fund an open-ended stream because this is a settlement mission. And a settlement mission means you don't just send one group to Mars and abandon them. You have to follow it up with more people, more equipment, more supplies. Every other year when you can launch to Mars, you do that. And so you have to reinforce the people. The first people that land on the beach have to be reinforced with more and more and more, and you got to take the beach, you got to take the continent, you got to take the planet. That's what this is about. So if this is to be done privately, what has to be done is they have to build up a large organization of people that will keep funding missions. And now that's not unprecedented. If you look at the most daring episodes of colonization in human history, such as, say, the Pilgrims coming to Massachusetts or the Mormons going to Utah or the Jews going to Palestine in the more recent period, they've all been done by home front organizations funding the people who actually went. And so, in a sense, what Mars needs is its own Theodore Herzl. Okay, that's what it needs if you're going to do this. Not a reality TV show, but a global organization of people that are behind it. Now, of course, the U.S. government also has a financial engine that is easily sufficient to do this. And in a way, I mean, one of the very positive things about Mars One is, as a thought experiment, you say, look, why not? What would it take to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, gee, you could do this for a very small fraction of NASA's budget. You could send people to Mars. You could have a colony on Mars. And you wouldn't be going to Mars with flags and footprints. You'd be going to Mars to establish a new branch of human civilization. And as long as we do have a space program in this country, why don't we spend a fraction of our budget to actually have humans expand into space?
Why not use your program, though? And in your idea, of course, was to be able to come back by, creating your own fuel system out of Mars, taking
sure.
the water out and stuff.
Well, actually, of course, as you might suspect, my strongest support is for my own plan. But yes, look, if you want to do a round trip mission, then the best way to do it is make your return propellant on Mars. And in fact, you can send the return ship to Mars first, have it make its return propellant automatically on Mars first. So there's no question about will the propellant making, you know, work or not, and will you be stranded? No, the propellant making.
That'll already be done and waiting for you.
Exactly. And that's how I prefer to do the mission. Now, at some point, of course, I do want to send people to Mars to stay, because that is the whole point of the exercise. The whole point of the exercise is not just to go to Mars and say you did it, or not just to go to Mars even and do substantial exploration, which would be valuable to resolve this question of life in the universe, but to pave the way for the human settlement of Mars. It would be preferable, in my opinion, though, to do some exploration missions before you do settlement missions. However, if you're operating on a shoestring, as Mars One is, it is much cheaper just to cut right to the chase and do the settlement straight up.
Well, and also, though, with your idea about Mars, you want to terraform Mars. You want it to get to the point where these human beings can leave their bubble homes and actually go and breathe in a Mars atmosphere, correct?
Well, that's true, but that's for the future. We
right.
don't have the capability of terraforming Mars, you know, in our time, in a few years, and even a few decades. What, the terraformation of Mars is a task for the settlers of Mars, and I think they'll do it. I think it's in their interests, and also simply it's in their nature. It's in the nature of life to take barren environments and transform them into those that are friendly for the development of life. So that will be done, but that is a task of centuries, not of years.
Who is funding at this point, because they haven't done a reality show, Mars One?
Well, what happened was they put out an open call. They said, we're sending people to Mars. Who will volunteer? Send in an application, and it's a $30 application fee. And they got 80,000 applications. So that's
a little starting capital, huh?
Yeah, that's $2 million. So they got some money that way. Actually, it surprised me how well they were received. I mean, look, the idea of doing something like this has crossed my mind in the past, but I thought if I got up and said, we're sending people Mars, everybody send money, very few people would. We wouldn't get enough money to do it, and those who sent their money would say, gee, he swindled me, I don't want to do that. So I have focused my fundraising efforts on projects that I thought we could actually
do. Realistic
like
things.
Like the building of the Mars Arctic Research Station uh-huh. and the Mars Desert Research Station, which we did. And there's a crew in our desert station right now. But Boss Lonsdorf, the head of Mars One, took the bold approach, and he got quite a response. And that has given him some working capital. And I think there's a good chance he will, in fact, get a reality TV show. But
I don't know what it'll pay, but you're right. He will get that show.
Yeah, he'll get a show. And that will keep Mars One in business, but that won't provide them anything like the kind of money they need to send people to Mars.
I mean, it'll be pretty repetitious after a while, I would think. You know?
Yeah.
If for these reality shows to work, Robert, you need drama and
right.
arguments
well,
and fighting.
Drama is the down-select process. But the, you know, all these people hope to go to Mars, and who will be eliminated?
What are the possibilities that, you know, they raised $2 million. I'm sure they put a disclaimer in there that said this is not a guarantee we're going to Mars. And the project just dies by the wayside. Somebody's made a lot of money.
Well, that point has been made. I've met Boss Lonsdorf. I do not think he is a scam artist. He does not appear to be living in you know enormous riches. He seems to live in ordinary you know middle class income and so forth. And with $2 million and a staff of five people, and this thing's been going you know over a year now, 2 years. In fact, they may be getting a little thin on resources. I would think that. They did raise another $250,000 on a crowdfunding campaign, But
Jeez.
I think he's very much an optimist and is someone who says, you know, we can do it, we can do it, and I think he'll get a TV show and that will pay him and his staff for a while.
Well,
But
in order to get the TV show, don't you think we got to get to Mars first?
no, they're going to get a TV show on the dealing with the process of down selecting this 100 families.
Ah, I see. Just following the finalists and their lives and things like that.
Yeah, so he'll get a TV show in the here and now. I mean, I imagine that we'll see a Mars One TV show within a year. You're acquainted with media and TV and so forth, and there's some potential for such a show, but it could run a year, it could run 2 years, and I don't see it, you know, it getting higher ratings than, you know, 24 or something. I
No.
mean,
Now,
so
if you had the Kardashians on Mars, maybe.
yeah, but even so, if you look at the highest rated TV shows, how much money do they actually make? Some have made millions of dollars. I don't know
Not enough to get you to Mars
that's right.
at all. Tell me about your interest, Robert. I mean, you and I have been talking for years now, but what got you really into this push to terraform Mars and also the Mars program?
What got me interested in humans to Mars? Sputnik.
Really?
Yeah. I was
1957.
five when Sputnik flew, and I was already reading science fiction. And while, to the adult world, Sputnik may have been terrifying, it meant the Russians could launch satellites. To me, it was just great, because what it showed was that this world, this future of people traveling in space was going to be real. And I wanted to be part of it.
Well,
And
then you
it
jumped
was me
in
ever
a big
since.
way. Good for you. Where do we stand as a nation these days with our space program? I mean, what's going on anyway?
Well, it's adrift.
That's what I thought.
And as I said, this is where I think Mars One is made a positive contribution. They've pointed the way. They say, how about doing this? And really, there's no question that NASA could do it, but instead we're spending $17 billion a year. And I mean, part of the organization is productive. The part that does robotic missions, they know what they're doing.
And they're doing a great job with that.
Right, but that's a fraction of NASA. And the biggest part of NASA is the manned spaceflight program, and they're just adrift. I mean, if you look at their program, you say, where are you going to be 10 years from now that you're not now and that you weren't 10 years ago? And the answer is nothing.
They have no answer.
They're just going round and round. They say, oh, we want to send humans to Mars, but it's out in the never never. Okay, in other words, they have a vision, they don't have a program.
Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk more about going to Mars, the red planet. Final hour, we'll take phone calls. Would you go to Mars and not come back? I'll ask you that next hour. Going to continue chatting with Robert Zubrin this hour, then we'll take your calls next hour on Coast to Coast. And welcome back, Robert Zubrin with us as we talk about all things space these days. What do you think of Mars's asteroid retrieval mission and NASA's ability to try to do that?
Okay, then NASA's asteroid retrieval mission is an example of total decortication of the NASA leadership. No, it's amazing. This total nonsense. Okay, what actually happened was this. Okay, as you know, George, the Bush administration had this program to return to the moon, which its administrator Mike Griffin was focused on, and I think this was a flawed plan, but at least it was a plan. And if it had been executed, we would have accomplished some real things in this decade. We'd be getting people back on the moon by 2019. Obama pulled the plug on that. He said, no, we don't want to do that. That's too small. Not my style, said Casey. Okay, so he said, we want to go beyond the moon. Going back to the moon is so 50 years ago. We have to go out into the solar system, and so as a first step on the way to Mars, we will send astronauts to visit asteroids, near-Earth asteroids that are traveling around the sun in, you know, in solar system heliocentric space. And so this had the minus of derailing what NASA had underway, but it had the plus of, yes, it would get you out into the solar system, out of, you know, Earth, Moon, space. So what NASA do? They said, well, okay, we'll go to an asteroid, but we don't want to leave Earth-centered space. So what we will do is we will capture a chunk of an asteroid, and I must emphasize that this is a chunk about 8 feet in diameter, okay? So this is not actually visiting an asteroid. It's visiting a rock. They're going to take a rock from an asteroid and notionally move it with ion propulsion and put it in orbit around the moon, and then we can go visit this rock without leaving Earth-centered space. So they completely undermine the entire purpose of Obama's initiative by doing this, okay? And, you know, they could also visit a chunk of an asteroid by going to the, you know, planetarium in New York City, where they have about an 8-foot diameter rock from space there. I mean, it's just absurd. And so they undermine it. Then you get to the fact that they actually don't know how to do this, because this 8-foot diameter rock is pretty heavy and it's tumbling. And so how are they going to stop it from tumbling with an automated spacecraft that you, ion propulsion is like, it's a very soft, very weak, very gentle form of propulsion. And it's very efficient on its fuel use, but it's kind of like having a car that gets 1,000 miles to the gallon but takes 1,000 years to go through.
Exactly. It'll get you there, but with no power.
You know. So first of all, I mean, the main problem with this mission is, number one, it does absolutely nothing except avoid doing the primary mission that Obama wanted to accomplish. And second of all, it doesn't even appear to be technically feasible.
How disappointing. Now, I mean, where are the people who have these visions? We don't have these visions, Robert, anymore.
I got a vision. But the people in NASA who really want to accomplish something, well, there's still some of them there, but most of them, you know, they join NASA. They join out of college or something. They say, I want to be part of, you know, space frontier. I'm going to do it. Here I am at NASA. I'm, you know, really out there, and then they just get discovered that it's a bureaucracy,
yeah.
And the best of them, or many of the best of them, leave. Now,
where do they go to, like SpaceX?
Yeah, well, some of them go there, or some of them just go into the private world and do whatever. I mean, there are some people here and there in NASA that do things, and certainly we have in the robotic program at Jet Propulsion Lab. Even they're a minority, but they're a stronger minority there, and they've accomplished some real stuff like getting rovers on Mars. The bureaucrats, you know, would rather not do anything. They'd rather just collect their checks and go golfing. You know, and because if you ever really want to do something ambitious, you're risking something. I mean, anytime you do something that hasn't been done before, you're putting it on the line. That's what they don't want to do.
I want to get your reaction to Robert, while we've got you tonight, to the plummeting oil prices. I mean, you've looked at breaking free of oil with your work, Energy Victory. What do you think of this? What's going on here?
Now, I'm all for low oil prices,
yes,
but the unfortunate thing is that what's going on here, this is a form of economic warfare that the Saudis have launched to wreck the American oil resurgence. And once they succeed in doing that, they will hike the price back up way over $100 a barrel, unless we counter this. That is, you see, here's the thing. Okay. Mind if I get a little technical here?
Let's do it.
Okay.
And explain it along the way.
Sure. Okay. Oil is born in a geological formation. It's called shale. Okay, it's this heavy layered sedimentary rocks. There's, you know, the algae, the organisms from the past, they fall to the bottom of the ocean. Sediments go on top of them. Over time, they are crushed, and under pressure and heat, it's turned into oil and gas. And that's where the oil is born, and that's where it is trapped But it while it's in the shale, it's trapped in microscopic little bubbles. And in fact, if you look at a piece of shale, you don't know you're looking at oil. It looks like you're looking at a rock. But in fact, there's oil and gas in there. The oil that we've been able to get up till 10 years ago or so was oil that somehow managed to escape from the shale through tiny cracks in it and make it up into the looser rock above the shale where it would pool together, and then someone could drill down to that and get it. And but that oil, you have to understand, was in transit, because the oil, after it breaks out of the shale, is on a trip towards the surface, where if it finally breaks through the surface, it forms an oil seep and it's lost to the environment. So the conventional oil that humanity has exploited from 1859 until about the year 2000 is all oil that has, you know, of course it had to be born in the first place, but it had to escape from the shale and then not make it all the way to the surface. So only the oil, the in-between oil, that's what we've been depending on. There's much larger amounts of oil down there in the shale that has never escaped. Now, what happened was, in 1998, experimentally, they found a way to get the oil out of the shale. And then, since around 2007, 2008, this has been implemented in a significant commercial way here in the United States, primarily in North Dakota, and it's been a tremendous success, and we've increased U.S. oil production by 50% since 2008 by getting oil out of shale in North Dakota. Now, the thing is, this has the potential to go worldwide. What we've done by developing this new technology is we've taken something that was not a resource before, that was just a rock, and we've turned it into a resource. It's like so many other things. You use aluminum.
Yeah, it's like being a wizard.
What?
It's like being a wizard.
That's right. It's like being a wizard, okay? You know, oil itself was not a resource until we developed oil refining and then the ways to use the oil, okay? So oil has replaced, you know, hay, which fed horses. Now we have oil and it moves cars. But, you know, people 200 years ago, oil was not a resource. Aluminum was not a resource 150 years ago. No pioneer of the American West ever saw a piece of aluminum, yet it's second most common element in the Earth's crust. They never saw it. They had no idea how to get it out of the rock. Well, now we've gotten something else out of the rock. We've gotten oil out of the rock, okay? Yeah, and there's vast amounts of this worldwide. I mean, there are countries that you wouldn't think about. Have enormous oil resources in the form of shale, like, say, Poland, for example.
Sure, huge.
Okay, France, okay, even Germany, England. Now, Putin has unleashed a massive movement in Europe to try to ban fracking. Fracking is how you get this stuff out of the shale. And he has been successful in banning fracking in France and Germany. This is part of his plan for crushing Europe economically, keeping them dependent on Russian gas. The Poles aren't going to go for that. What I'm saying is that OPEC's strength strictly resides around the fact that they happen to be sitting on 80% of the world's conventional oil reserves, the old kind of oil, the easy oil. Now, if all of a sudden shale can be turned into oil, it means their monopoly is completely broken.
It's over.
Right. So they are trying to destroy the American shale oil revolution in its cradle. Or right now, it's not quite in its cradle. It's in kindergarten.
Robert, does this back up my belief of the abiotic oil theory, that this planet has an abundance of oil, whether it's in shale or, as you say, the old type of oil, but it's all over the place?
Well, it certainly backs up your belief that oil is all over the place. The shale oil is not abiotic. It is. It comes from organisms from the distant past. It's well understood how shale oil, I mean, there may be abiotic oil as well. That's a different question altogether.
Okay. Right.
Okay. But what this is about is the fact that all of a sudden, this thing that was not a resource before is now a massive resource. And, you know, this is what's fun. I mean, look, land was not a resource until we developed agriculture. It was just the stuff you had to travel over, okay, to get where you wanted to go. And then as we improved agricultural technology, we've multiplied the value of land as a resource, okay? You know, fish in the ocean are not a resource until you develop fishing technology. Uranium was not a resource until we developed nuclear power, okay? It was... You know, so here it is. Shale was not a reason. I have a piece of shale in my office. You just look at it. It just looks like a rock. There's oil in that. I don't think so. I mean, this is a rock, but it's there. It's microscopic, but it's there. And you frack it, you crack it, and out the oil and gas comes. And I must say, by the way, now it also produces, in addition to oil, a lot of associated gas, which is a mixture of methane, ethane, propane, you know, like you use in a propane barbecue, butane, like you use in a cigarette lighter. There's all kinds of stuff that comes up. Right now in North Dakota, they're flaring a lot of this associated gas because it comes up as a mixture of this stuff, and all mixed together, it's not useful. But my company and others have developed mobile systems now that can go to the site of the flare and separate this stuff out, and then you get the liquid. You could put it in a truck and tank it away, and you get dry gas that you can use to replace diesel fuel for your oil drilling operation. I have a company called Pioneer Energy that is making machines that can do that, and there's some other people that have mobile systems that can do that now too. So that's an additional resource of making more plentiful gas as well as natural gas liquids like propane, which is a very useful thing too.
This is dramatic with what the Saudis are doing, and when they raise it, it's going all the way back up and then some, I think.
Right. Now, so there's a couple of things we can do about this, okay? One is we could tariff OPEC oil, okay?
All right.
That's one thing. That's a classic response to an economic warfare move of this kind. And that would mean that people would be back at $2.50 gas instead of $2 gas. But it's a lot better to be at $2.50 gas long term, then be at $2 gas for a little while, then be at $5 gas forever after.
That's right. You get hurt that way.
And another thing we could do is, I'll just say it, bomb Karg Island. Karg Island is the Iranian oil export terminal. Okay? Now, and over 65% of Iranian oil goes through Karg Island. And it's a very soft target. You know, everybody talks about how we could, it's so hard to hit those Iranian nuclear bomb factories. They're deep underground. You don't have to hit them. You just got to hit the oil export terminal that provides the money to run them. And
which is probably where ISIS is making some money, too.
Well, ISIS is making money on other oil facilities. They're not backed by Iran.
But who's buying
other backers? But the here's the thing: people want to stop the Iranian oil, the Iranian nuclear bomb program. The weak point is their oil export terminal. It's just this place. It's lots of tanks that are filled with oil. You know, a couple of dozen bombs hit that place. It all goes up in flames, and that's the end of the Iranian nuclear bomb program. No bucks, no bombs. And that, by the way, is what Netanyahu should do.
Well, he's probably thinking about that.
Yeah.
You know,
but
he's
I'd
at
be thinking
arms
about if I was him, and maybe that's what he's coming to the U.S. to explain.
Maybe. You might be right. Now, give me your take on ISIS, then. Who's buying the oil from the fields they have captured?
Turkey. You know,
is it cheap? Is it cheap oil? Is that why they're doing
sure.
it?
In other words, sure, yeah, because it's a black market thing. So they get the oil, they've stolen it, and so they'll sell it for $30 a barrel or something to Turkey. What do they care? It's just
what I don't understand,
money.
Robert, I mean, who's running the oil refineries in Iraq and wherever they are? Who's doing that? They have employees?
Well, they've got some people there, but the real question is why haven't we struck these
places? Well, exactly.
This is totally nonsense. You know, in World War II, we knocked out Nazi Germany's lights by knocking out their oil production. The last German panzer offensive literally ran out of gas right on the battlefield.
Maybe we think we're going to get them out of there and we don't want to damage anything.
Well, or maybe the effort isn't serious. This whole idea that it should take, that here you have ISIS that has, you know, maybe 40,000 fighters, which is about as many as the Taliban had in 2001, okay?
All armed, and, all heavily armed, right?
Yes, the Taliban was heavily armed, too. And what did we sweep them out with? We had some local opponents, the Northern Alliance, and then we sent in, you know, a few thousand Rangers and paratroopers to help them and gave them serious tactical air support, and we just swept through them. And while the Taliban weren't wiped out, they were knocked out of power and put into guerrilla status within a couple of months. And here you have ISIS. I mean, ISIS is holding the city of Mosul with 2,000 men. Okay, and they say, well, in a couple of years, we may be able to take it back.
Well, they said today, the Iraqis said today, they're going back in April or May with 25,000 men. Why are they taking so long?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. But why are we taking so long? I mean, look, we have been engaged. Obama declared war, as it were, on ISIS in September. Okay, so it's 5 months. I mean, this is incredible. You know, just doing a modest amount of airstrikes doesn't do anything.
No, not
you know,
at all.
And you had, you know, the only significant defeat that has been administered to ISIS was delivered to them by the Kurds.
Robert, maybe they don't want them out. Let's talk about that and take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.